Welcome into another edition of The Intersection with conversation about a variety of topics, including news, information, and lifestyles approached from a Christian worldview perspective. Well, a few years back, author David Gregory released the book Dinner with a Perfect Stranger, which inspired a movie and subsequent books about Jesus coming into modern-day settings. In his latest novel, a young woman encounters Jesus in the time period in which he lived on Earth. Plus, October is a time designated to honor spiritual leadership in our churches, and Larry Magnuson visited with me recently to shed some light on the challenges that pastors face and how they need affirmation. Also, you'll be hearing from Emily Bells of World Magazine, who discusses the expansion of Planned Parenthood while some abortion providers close their doors. Plus, on this edition of The Intersection from the Clarion Project, Ryan Morrow brings some perspective into the operation of radical Islam, an ideology with spiritual components that we see manifested in terrorism. Finally, it's Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel defending Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore in light of charges brought against him for his activity related to same-sex marriage in light of the Obergefell ruling. This is The Intersection, a production of The Meeting House. I'm Bob Crittenden. David Gregory is a best-selling author who has written a number of nonfiction as well as fiction books, including Dinner with a Perfect Stranger. His latest is called Open. Get ready for the adventure of a lifetime, in which his main character travels to the time of Jesus, where she learns some valuable lessons about the Savior. Here now is David Gregory.
Yeah, Dinner with a Perfect Stranger turned out to be just about the biggest surprise of my life. I was at Dallas Seminary at the time, and I wanted to write a book that contained some concepts from my first theology class there. And so I was thinking writing a nonfiction book, because I'd written a couple of nonfiction books already. And then the Lord gave me the idea, why don't you put this into a story? And so I came up with this storyline about Jesus coming to have dinner at a nice Italian restaurant with a modern-day skeptic, a guy in his 30s. And so Dinner with a Perfect Stranger is exactly what the title says it is. It's simply a story about Jesus meeting for dinner with a guy at an Italian restaurant in Cincinnati. And the guy goes thinking it's a prank by some friends of his at work, and he discovers it really is Jesus. And so, really, it's kind of one of those, what would you want to talk to Jesus about if you had him to yourself for 2 hours kind of premises. And so, really, it was a message that I wanted to have available to give to people in story form. And so we self-published it. I, had 1,000 or so copies on hand and figured, well, if I can count enough family and friends to buy these things, I'll break even. And then Random House got a hold of it, and they ended up selling 500,000 copies. And so it turned out to be a bestseller, which was the biggest surprise of my life, because I had no thought that had ever entered my mind that something like that would happen. And all of a sudden, I had a fiction writing career dumped in my lap. And so, as you said, 6 books later, here I am coming out with a new book. And so the new book, Open, really is the reverse premises. It's the main character is a woman named Emma Jameson. She's in her late 20s. She's a believer, a Christian. And she's discouraged in her life at the moment. She's more than discouraged. She's just had a breakup of a significant relationship. Her career is kind of on... Well, it's not on the rocks, it's stalled, and God just feels far away, and she's just wondering, hey, what relevance do any of these stories I'm reading in the Gospels here, for instance, have to my life? Jesus, calming the storm on the water of the Sea of Galilee, is like, okay, fine, that's a great story. What does this have to do with me? And so she magically, she gets an envelope on her kitchen table that says, go through the nearest open door and have a for a real adventure with Jesus. And she ends up going through her pantry door, and she immediately is swept into the scene of the storm on the Sea of Galilee. She's sitting on the boat, the waves are coming over, it's a huge storm, and she is thrust into this world in which she begins to experience one after another a lot of the gospel stories with Jesus, and being able to interact with Jesus in real time in those stories. And so rather than Jesus coming to the present day, I take a character from the present day and put her back into the biblical times with Jesus.
David, share with me the backstory, your inspiration for actually writing this book.
Well, my books are always message books. And some people that to some people that's a bad word in the fiction realm. But I always think of to me I always think of what message do I want to communicate? What do I really want the takeaway for people to be? How do I want them to think about things perhaps in a way that they haven't thought about things before? And then I craft a story around that. And I simply thought in this case, having the main character, I wanted a main character whose conception of the Christian life was going to be challenged. And I thought, because her what she had experienced with the Christian life was just very standard, you know, kind of a standard evangelical church. Hey, you know, try your best to be a good Christian, do the right things, do your Bible studies, go to church, you know, be part of a fellowship group. Et cetera, et cetera. And it just wasn't working for her anymore. And she's just thinking, okay, there's got to be more to it than this. And so I thought, what better way to address her situation than to take her back and having her actually interact with Jesus on the spot? And so that was the conception behind the book.
David Gregory here on The Intersection. Learn more about him through the website davidgregorybooks.com. Well, recently I had a chance to talk with Larry Magnuson, co-author with Jimmy Dodd of the book Pastors Are People Too, What They Won't Tell You, But You Need to Know. In our conversation, he discussed some of the challenges faced by parents and how congregation members can provide encouragement. He and his wife Barbara serve as president of Sunscape Retreats. Here now is Larry Magnuson.
Those in ministry are dealing with eternal issues, and they're dealing with oftentimes people in their crises and in their deepest, darkest times. Now, absolutely, pastors get to watch people come to Christ. They have the opportunity to see marriages restored, but they spend a lot of time wrestling with people at their most difficult moments, and they're carrying that load. Oftentimes, pastors, they suffer from compassion fatigue, from secondary stress they carry for the people in their congregation. And too often, the first thing that tends to go when the pressures mount is the pastor's own time with the Lord, and then their time with their families. So it's critical that pastors remain healthy for the sake of the people they serve.
Give us an idea about the number of pastors that are leaving the ministry and some of the reasons why.
You know, there are a lot of statistics out there, and statistics can be bent in a lot of directions. But, you know, it's said as many as 1,500 are leaving ministry every month, not from retirement, but throwing in the towel. Whatever the number is, it is too high. And oftentimes, the issues are issues that could be corrected. First of all, just plain burnout, just fatigue, being overwhelmed, getting to the end of your rope. Conflict in the church. Conflict takes a toll on everyone, but it certainly takes a toll on pastors. Pastors care about people. They want to serve. And this constant conflict wears the pastor down. The fact that you can lose your perspective on your journey with the Lord as being important, because pastors need to walk with the Lord as well. So in all of it, there is this danger, this pressure. We talk about it as being currents that can take pastors to a place they never intended to get to if they're not careful and aware, and they need the help of the people in their church.
And I wanted you to address the whole concept of managing conflict, whether it be the pastor doing what he can to minimize and even resolve conflict, but also congregation and lay leaders in the church that also have a role in minimizing and resolving conflict.
You know, one of the problems we see a lot in the church is what we call passive-aggressive behavior. People that are not upfront with their concerns, their issues, their needs, it leaks out in other ways. One of the things that can be most helpful is if people have a concern, go to their pastor, speak to them honestly and openly, but go first with a sense of appreciation. But then, this is my concern, whatever that concern might be. A lot of times in the church, there is not the ability to just say what the issue is, and that's critically important. The other thing is, there are pastors, just like there are people, that are good with conflict, and there are pastors that are not as good with conflict. Leadership teams that come alongside pastors and help them in their areas of weakness is really a great help to pastors. They need to know their pastor. They need to know the strength. They need to know the weakness. They need to know how to help.
Larry Magnuson here on The Intersection. Find out more about Sunscape Retreats by going to sunscape.org. Also, Jimmy Dodd, the co-author, is founder and president of PastorServe. That website is pastorserve.net. Well, this is The Intersection Podcast with Emily Bells, reporter for World Magazine and World News Group. Recently, she talked about a story she had written about the growth of Planned Parenthood at a time when abortion rates are declining and smaller clinics are closing. Here now is Emily Bells.
This is just expanding their business footprint in the city, which is interesting because the rate of abortions in New York is actually going down. It's still very high, but the rate is going down. So kind of looking at why is Planned Parenthood opening all these big facilities when the abortion rate in New York and in other parts of the country is declining.
Interesting. Now, this is a 14,000 square foot facility in Queens. Is the one in Manhattan also a relatively large facility?
You know, I'm not positive about the square footage of the one in Manhattan, but I think this is the biggest one that they've built in the city. I went inside and it feels like you're going into a huge department store or something like that. It's very beautiful. They've designed it very well. It's a lot of sunlight, so it doesn't feel like you're going into some, they're trying to portray this whole image that it is a kind of an Apple store sort of feel, that you're going in to get this safe health care from them. That's the vibe that they're trying to give out with the design of this new facility. And it's really beautifully done, to be honest.
Well,
in a deceptive way.
Oh, absolutely. And this is as you report, Cecile Richards, the president of Planned Parenthood for America, saying this facility, $9 million, is the North Star of the organization. And interestingly enough, about $1 million of that was provided by taxpayers.
That's right. And that's local taxpayers in New York City and in the state. That's in addition to the, money that they already get from state Medicaid and federal funding and all that. So there's a lot of public money that's going into these huge facilities.
Well,
I was surprised to learn that as well.
Well, give us an idea of the lay of the land when we look at the abortion industry. Obviously, Planned Parenthood opening up this crown jewel, if you will, in Queens and New York City. Planned Parenthood continuing to expand. However, as you mentioned, the rate of abortions was it New York City or the state of New York actually declining?
But
you see a lot of abortion centers in the state that have closed since 2013. So as you point out, it seems like Planned Parenthood is growing, but at the expense of these other smaller centers that are closing.
Yeah, that's exactly what we found. I was confused that Planned Parenthood was opening these huge facilities all over the country. And I should mention Americans United for Life, which is a pro-life organization, they have done a really good job of documenting Planned Parenthood's opening of these massive facilities. You might call them the big box Planned Parenthoods. And so these facilities meet the ambulatory surgical center requirements in a lot of states that have passed those restrictions on abortion centers. So they are kind of immune to a lot of the restrictions that pro-life legislatures have passed. But they've been opening all over the country, even as these smaller clinics are closing. So what we found in doing this report is that because the abortion rate is going down, abortion centers are having to consolidate, and Planned Parenthood is reaping the benefit from that because they have these big facilities. So a lot of their smaller competitors are shutting down, are closing for a number of reasons, and Planned Parenthood is consolidating and expanding all these big big box stores, you might say, around the country. So they're really, even though there have been all of these efforts at the state level to restrict abortion clinics, Planned Parenthood's really thriving right now.
Emily Bell's here on The Intersection. Find out more by going to worldmag.com. This is The Intersection Podcast, a weekly production of The Meeting House. Learn more through meetinghouseonline.info. When you go there, you will find a link to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand. Also, through that site, you can subscribe to The Intersection and have it delivered to your podcast receiving software, including iTunes, on a weekly basis. Two blogs are accessible. One is The Three, with three stories of relevance to the Christian community. The other is The Front Room, with devotional thoughts and commentary from the Meeting House program. And you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. Video content is accessible also. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Well, continuing now with this edition of The Intersection, it's Ryan Morrow, National Security Analyst for the Clarion Project and Adjunct Professor for Liberty University Online. In our conversation, he discussed the operation of radical Islamic extremism and its effect on attacks in Minnesota and New York City. From that conversation, this is Ryan Morrow.
Well, it's not because it pays well. And that's not just me being sarcastic. I'm saying that because the deputy spokesperson for the State Department, who worked for the CIA, actually said ISIS is caused by poverty and lack of jobs. And so that's a common way of thinking that's still infecting our government's response that needs to be corrected. But why do they join these types of groups? Really, it just comes down to adopting the ideology. They first believe, usually they first believe in the concept of an Islamic state, that as a Muslim, they are required to fight for an Islamic state, a caliphate, wage jihad, implement a theocracy, all of these broad concepts. And then after you have that foundation, you have other Islamist terrorist groups that say, well, this is how you implement those radical concepts. You're supposed to blow someone up in New York. You're supposed to suicide bomb Jews in Israel. And you're supposed to do X, Y, and Z. So the reason that's important is because if we're discussing a strategy to stop all of this, you're going to have to go after that Islamist foundation, those that interpret their faith as a competing government to the American government, to Western governments, because that's where these terrorists recruit from. That is the first stage of radicalization. Right now, our strategy is all about the guys who are setting off a bomb right now, and that's just one manifestation of that overall threat. And I would say it's actually not even the most threatening manifestation of the threat, because they are reckless. It results in us responding, and that limits their own success. The smarter ones, they wait. They're more pragmatic. They're more strategic in their thinking.
And I think now would be actually a good time, as we were talking about the route that you have so many people taking to become radicalized, is as far as Islamic extremism. Something that you do with the Clarion Project is really attempt to empower and challenge what could be called voices of moderation within the Muslim community, because even though there is the teaching of the radical viewpoint within Islam, within the teachings of the Quran, percentage-wise, you have a small percentage that actually become radicalized and buy into this concept of what would be called physical jihad. So you're trying to raise up the moderates as a strategy to really counter this radical point of view.
That's right. We put out a film called By the Numbers that went through the polls and it showed that something like a third of the Muslim world have radical points of view, some that, including those that may not support ISIS but support honor killings. We put them in that pool. And so you get about a third, but then especially in the American Muslim community, it's like nothing even close to that, much more moderate. And I sometimes get challenged for my alliances with Muslims. Some of my best intelligence sources are Muslims. And sometimes I get challenged as, how as a Christian can I be doing this? How come I'm not attacking Islam and attacking the Muslim community to try to get them to convert? And honestly, I know I'm doing what God wants me to do. I have meetings with Muslim activists, and I will feel the motivation, the presence of God there in ways that are more powerful than many meetings I have with Christians and with Jews. That alone is what is going to be what guides me. But intellectually, it's also that's where the solution comes from. We have to work with those that want to work with us, that aren't threatening us. The theological debate can happen with people that are more suited to discuss it, which wouldn't be me. But we shouldn't have to divide ourselves from friends and from people that we can care about and have close relationships with on the basis of faith. So if they have if they're being threatened, as moderate Muslims are, that's just as much of a concern to me as a Christian being threatened. I need to react in the same way.
Ryan Morrow here on The Intersection. You can learn more about the Clarion Project at theclarionproject.org. His website is ryanmorrow.com. Well, finally, on this edition of The Intersection, it's Matt Staver, founder and chairman of Liberty Council. He shared an update with me prior to the Wednesday, September 28th trial of Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore before Alabama's Court of the Judiciary regarding a complaint about an order he had written following the U.S. Supreme Court's Obergefell decision on same-sex marriage. According to the Liberty Council website, on Friday, September 30th, and I quote, "Today, the Court of the Judiciary issued a decision on the charges against Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice Roy Moore. The Judicial Inquiry Commission, JIC, requested that he be removed from the bench. Under the COJ rules, removal requires a unanimous 9-0 vote by the members of the COJ, which is made up of judges, a lawyer, and lay people." The website goes on to say that absent a 9-0 unanimous vote, the COJ cannot remove a judge from the bench. But according to Liberty Counsel, in an unbelievable violation of the law, as Liberty Counsel says, the COJ suspended without pay Chief Justice Roy Moore for the remainder of his term, which runs through January 2019. Liberty Counsel pointing out the suspension until the end of his term is a de facto removal from the bench. Here now from that conversation prior to the trial is Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel.
Yes, the JIC filed charges against Chief Justice Roy Moore in May, and he's been automatically removed from the bench ever since. That's the unusual procedure that Alabama has, unlike the other 49 states, which allow someone to defend themselves before they actually are removed from office. In this case, the Alabama process is that any judge is automatically removed from office pending the investigation, pending the hearing, if you will. And that can take months, as in this case, or years in some other cases. So when these charges were issued, he was automatically removed from Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, where he was elected. And the charge centers around a January 2016 four-page administrative order. The JIC alleges that the Chief Justice in that four-page order advocated outright open rebellion by the probate judges against the United States Supreme Court marriage opinion. And that's completely untrue. In fact, when you read this particular four-page order, it's pretty clear that it does nothing of the sort. Indeed, in paragraph 10 of that particular order, it's very clear what it says. It says specifically, and I'm quoting, "I am not at liberty to provide any guidance to Alabama probate judges on the effect of Obergefell," which is the U.S. Supreme Court opinion, "on the existing orders of the Alabama Supreme Court. That issue remains before the entire court, which continues to deliberate the matter." Now, you can't get any more clear than that. That's not open, outright rebellion at all. It's just simply a status report, an update that the matter is still pending before the Alabama Supreme Court. It'll come down with a ruling sometime in the future. It doesn't say which way it's going to go. He didn't know which way it was going to go. 2 months later, the Alabama Supreme Court finally did come down with its ultimate decision. So that's the issue. That's the order. And because of this order, the Southern Poverty Law Center filed a complaint, and the Judicial Inquiry Commission issued the charge, and then they turned around and hired the former legal director of the Southern Poverty Law Center to be the prosecutor against the Chief Justice.
And there was a hearing that took place back in August. It was before the Court of the Judiciary, which basically hears these cases where the JIC has filed a charge. Tell me about what took place in that hearing, if you would.
Well, the hearing lasted about an hour, and the Judicial Inquiry Commission, as well as we on behalf of the Chief Justice, filed motions for summary judgment, meaning that we both agreed on this one matter, that there's no dispute in the facts, that there's no reason for a trial, that the case should be decided right then and there. That's one area in which the JIC and Liberty Counsel on behalf of the Chief Justice agreed. I've never been in a situation in 29 years of litigation where both sides agree that there's no reason for a trial, that there's no dispute in the facts, that's a pure question of law and the case should be decided, and the court not do so. But in this case, despite the fact that both parties said there was no reason to go any further, decide it now, we have it fully briefed, no dispute in the facts, no reason for a trial, the Court of the Judiciary, before I even got on a plane to leave Alabama that same day, denied the motions and set the case for trial about 2 months down the road, which is September the 28th. So that's where we'll be in court. And really, it's just a replay of what we did in August. It should have been decided then. It should have been clearly decided in the Chief Justice's favor.
From a pretrial conversation, that is Matt Staber. The Liberty Counsel website is lc.org. Well, that just about wraps up this edition of the Intersection Podcast, a weekly production of The Meeting House. The website address, again, is meetinghouseonline.info. When you go there, you will find a link to the download center marked Meeting House On Demand, through which you can listen to, download, or share full conversations with recent guests featured on the Intersection Podcast. Also, through that site, you can subscribe to The Intersection. Plus, there are two blogs accessible. And you can follow me on Twitter and access the Meeting House Facebook page. You can also get connected to video content. Again, that website address is meetinghouseonline.info. Thanks for joining me for this week's edition of the Intersection Podcast. I'm Bob Crittenden.